You're listening to Commute, the podcast. Congratulations, you'll be smarter when you get there.
What up? Welcome into Commute, the podcast. I'm Dave.
And I'm Jay.
And we are about to take you on a deep dive on three topics that we find interesting, and we're betting that you might just find them interesting too. We can promise you this, you'll be smarter when you get there. On this edition of Commute.
If you've ever traveled to England, you may notice that drivers do things a little differently there. We'll discuss what pushed British cars to the left side of the road.
It's hard to believe, but one of the best times of the year is back, March Madness. But this year is a little different, because this year it's the women's tournament that's the hottest ticket in town, and it all centers around one generational player.
Sometimes a joke on the internet can get bigger than it was ever intended to be, and oftentimes that can lead to some unintended consequences.
All of that on this edition of Commute. Let's get it.
So, Dave, the thing about going outside of your hometown or maybe your home state is oftentimes you'll run into situations where maybe you've done one thing a particular way your entire life, and then you go to a new place and you realize, wait, they do this thing that I used to do this way, that way, and it takes a little bit of adjustment. So do you have a time that you can think of where you just really had to change your thinking? Like you had done something a particular way, then you went somewhere else, and they just did it in a completely different way.
Well, this is kind of along those lines. It's a little bit different, but you'll love this. So in many ways, I feel like it's a generational thing that there's etiquettes that perhaps are going to go away, or our generation views differently than the generations before us. So like, for example, at my work, a lot of people wear suits, which is great. But of my generation, like, we just don't really wear suits very often. So I probably wear a suit like two or three times a month. The other thing I do is I just do not like putting my napkin in my lap. So I feel like anytime I do that, I'm so fakey. Because I would just rather have my napkin on the table. Like, am I alone with this?
No, I mean, like, you've been called out on it before? Like, it's been a thing that people have, like, pointed out?
They don't point it out, but people give you this, like, huh. Well, his napkin's just wadded up on the table, slob.
I didn't realize we were just going to eat with our hands here.
Maybe we shouldn't have invited him to this very serious thing.
Well, Dave, we're going to be talking about one of these just like societal things that have been created, and it's different on opposite sides of the world, which I always think is interesting. So we here in America, we drive on the right side of the road everywhere, and in England, they drive on the left side of the road. And so it can kind of be this like trippy thing if you ever travel to England and you've only lived in the United States your whole life, and it takes a little bit of mental like adjustment to get used to. But the origins of that difference, I think, are interesting, because that's a difference that seems pretty big, especially whenever we're kind of connected to Britain. Like, a lot of our culture comes from Great Britain. So why is this a major difference? So the answer, Dave, as you would imagine, is complicated, involving everything from Conestoga wagons to Napoleon Bonaparte. In fact, Dave, this split isn't even around the world. Today, about 30% of the world's countries mandate left-side driving, while about 70% stay to the right. This story begins in the 1700s in rural Pennsylvania. An important vehicle of the time, called the Conestoga wagon, was a key part of life in the expanding United States. The wagons were developed to carry goods from the eastern coast to Philadelphia, and when wagon drivers moved them, they could sit on the horses pulling it, they could sit on the attached board, or if more active control was needed, the driver would walk alongside the horses and pull various levers and ropes. Since most people are right-handed, these controls would be placed on the left side, so they would be closer to the driver's right hand. This would mean that the driver would be in the middle of the road while the wagon was off to the right. Since so many of these wagons were coming and going and trade was expanding, America invested in the first major highway called the Philadelphia and Lancaster Turnpike Road, which opened in 1795, and in the official rules of the road, all traffic was expected to stay to the right. Then states started making it law, with New York mandating right-side driving first in 1804. Now, some will credit Henry Ford for pushing all traffic to the right, since the popular Model T car invented in 1908 had the steering wheel placed on the left side of the vehicle. But really, Ford was just responding to the norms that had been in place for over 100 years. And weirdly enough, most countries in Europe are like the United States. So how did England become such an outlier? Well, to nail that down, we have to go to France. Although rules had sort of been culturally established in which carriages and those on horseback would stay to the left and pedestrians to the right, it's important to remember that these lines often fell along class distinctions, since the poor didn't really have carriages and horses. When the French Revolution happened and many aristocrats started having afternoon appointments with guillotines, the revolutionary government ordered that everyone had to stay to the right side of the road to avoid class distinctions and do away with the traditional snobbery. As Napoleon and his armies marched through Europe, this practice spread with them to pretty much everywhere, except weirdly Sweden, which actually drove on the left until 1967, when they literally just all switched to the right. Britain was not influenced by this, since they were out of Napoleon's reach, and since horses and wagons tend to drift to the left, that's where they remained. Now, in today's world, we sort of had this weird societal difference left over from this time, and if you're thinking, I bet it's hard when people have to make this shift, you'd be right. Today, when visiting the UK, Americans and others find it particularly difficult to mentally jump the hurdle and get used to the switch. Crashes can and do even result from trying to unwind years of habit. But because of this, this is essentially a cultural difference that probably isn't going anywhere anytime soon. And I think it's an interesting example of how the way we've just done things in the past influence our present in some unexpected ways.
We've talked about this on the show before. There are a lot of cultural differences like this that we just have to kind of navigate with as we perhaps travel the world or meet people from different parts of the world. Penn State Harrisburg, their international student office, has a website with a bunch of cultural differences for international students to understand when they would come to the United States. I think they're a little bit off, though, when they're talking about eating culture and etiquette. Okay, getting back to my napkin in the lap. So, according to Penn State Harrisburg, in general, Americans eat quietly with their mouths closed. Not true.
I don't know about that.
Americans are loud, and we almost all chew with our mouths open. Burping is seen as rude, not a compliment to the cook. Now, I'm here to push it that we should change burping to a compliment to the cook. I hadn't even ever thought about that.
Kind of feel sorry for anyone traveling to America trying to understand American social norms, because this is like truly a bizarre place, really, like when you compare it to other places in the world.
There's also a list of interactions like female to female, male to male, male to female. Should you do these things? Hugs. Typically, it's like, yeah, but be careful about it. Holding hands. No, you don't just casually hold hands with someone. Greeting kisses. Those are also a big no-no on most of the people you meet in America.
Yeah, I don't think that's changing anytime soon.
Jay, we are in March. And man, I've got to say, March is one of my favorite times of the year. There are a lot of reasons for this. For starters, it officially signifies that we've made it through the worst 2 months of the year, January and February. The time changes, which it just did yesterday, meaning we get more daylight in our lives, and now we can shed some of our seasonal depression that all of us carry around. Seriously, though, man, nothing worse than it getting dark at 5 p.m. Like, how do people in Alaska live like that when it's dark for months?
I just got done watching True Detective Night Country on HBO, and that is where it takes place, is in Alaska. And I had that conversation with my wife every episode. We'd be like, how do people live here? Like, what are they doing? Like, why are they living there? Because it's like every scene, it's pitch black, and it's snow everywhere, and everybody just looks totally miserable all the time, constantly.
Do you get a stipend? Like, surely you're getting paid to live there, because that just seems so terrible.
I mean, it's like your work sends you there, or you're just like running away from a serious crime that you've committed in the States or something.
There's no in between. You're running from something, or you've begrudgingly accepted a gig that took you to Alaska. Jay, but most importantly, March means it's time for perhaps the greatest American sporting event we have, the NCAA March Madness Basketball Tournament. This year, Jay, things feel a little different, though, because while we've had no short supply of star power in March, we've rarely, if ever, seen something like the star power of Iowa Hawkeye guard Caitlin Clark. Jay Clark, who recently became the record holder for career scoring in all of Division I, that's both men and women, is the hottest ticket in town these days. The Big Ten women's basketball tournament in Minneapolis sold out for the first time ever, thanks largely to Clark. And Clark has been doing this all season long. Iowa's opponents this year, schools like Iowa State, Wisconsin, and Indiana, all set attendance records when they hosted Clark in Iowa. In fact, some schools, Jay, saw incredible one-of-a-kind increases, like Wisconsin, for example, saw an attendance spike of nearly 3.5 times the normal home game average. Every Clark away game sold out this season. Hey, think about that. Every Clark away game sold out this season, with crowds averaging over 13,000 attendees. And Jay, for both her skill and popularity, Clark has been compared to some of the game's transcendent stars, Larry Bird and LeBron James. But Debbie Antonelli, an analyst for ESPN and CBS, recently told the New York Times that Clark stands alone because she has no real comparison in the history of women's college basketball. "We have never seen anyone like this. This has the draw to the box office," she told the Times. "It is remarkable." Antonelli even went so far as to compare Clark to Taylor Swift, complete with her own version of the Swifties, appropriately nicknamed the Clarkies. And Jay, it's not just ticket sales that Clark has dramatically impacted. TV viewership for women's college basketball is up 60% from last year. And on some stations like Fox, women's basketball has done something it's never done before: drawn a bigger total audience than the men. Clark's January appearance at Ohio State drew over 18,000 fans, a women's record for Ohio State. And other schools, Jay, like Northern Iowa, well, they set records for season ticket sales just so fans could guarantee their seat for the one visit from Caitlin Clark. And Jay, more people often means more problems. And hosting Clark has brought with it its own issues. She travels with her own security team, unheard of in most areas of collegiate sports, and concession stands, parking attendants, and local hotels are all worked to capacity, even if it's just for one night. Clark recently announced her intentions to go pro and will play in the WNBA next year. While it's hard to see this level of popularity following her at the next level, it very well could. And regardless, if Iowa makes a run this year during the NCAA tournament, as it is expected to do, we'll be seeing record prices for the championship game, all thanks to one person and the legions of Clarkies that follow her.
It is amazing, too, like how just the changes in college sports have changed someone like her in that position where, you know, if she had been around a decade ago, like, it would have been illegal for her to take any money, basically, to do what she's doing and, like, make this big of a change and impact on the sport. But now it's like people are sitting there saying, like, should she really go into the WNBA? Because, I mean, if she stays another year, she'll make, like, millions of dollars, like, in, you know, advertising revenue and stuff like that. So it's just, like, a different landscape now. And I think we'll see a lot more of these stars kind of elevate themselves as they get the opportunity to just be in front of more cameras and make more money, be on commercials, like she's on State Farm commercials, you know, and things like that as they're in their college days.
If you were on a team with her, so now we're in this age of NIL and, like, you know, college athletes can get paid for a whole host of things. If you're on a team with her, though, and you know she's making, I'm just going to make this up, she's basically getting paid $2, $3, $4, $5 million a year, and you're getting, like, a local, like, breakfast diner's paying you $500. How are you feeling?
You're like, come eat at Mickey's. We got the breakfast special. It's $12. You can hoop on down here before the game or something like that. And you're just like feeling just completely violated.
After taxes, you're getting like $200.
So, Dave, both you and I are from small towns in the United States, specifically West Virginia. And one of the things about visiting a small town for the first time, especially with people who've lived there for a long time, is that you realize very quickly that small towns are just like really quirky. Like there's a lot of like random things that you only really know about a small town unless you just live there. And so when you go visit it and someone's there and they explain it to you, you kind of have to like get up to speed. So I know in my hometown, for instance, there's a guy who is a legend by the name of Dancing Randy. I have no idea what his name is. I don't even think his name is Randy. Like, I think it's just a name he was given. But he earned this nickname because at every thing where there would be music publicly, so the carnival that comes to the hometown once a year, the county fair, which is a little bit down the road, he's there. And he's just dancing. Like, he's alone. He's not with anyone. He's just, like, standing by the big ride, just dancing to whatever song's on. Or he's at the fair just dancing. And so you kind of have to explain Dancing Randy to someone who, like, visits the town. It's like, oh, yeah, it's Dancing Randy. And like, you have to get them up to speed a little bit. So can you kind of think of anything in a maybe a town you've lived in or maybe your hometown where it's just a thing that you just kind of had to be there, otherwise you just don't really get it?
Yeah, two things I love to do, and my wife hates both of them, is to go over my family tree. So if somebody, like, let's just say, she'll just randomly say, so your cousin, what's his wife's name again? And that'll start me into, well, you know, my grandpa's sister so-and-so was married to so-and-so, who was the judge, who, I mean, I just love doing it. I could just go forever on a family tree. So I love doing that, and I love driving people around my hometown and talking about things like this. And there's one of my favorites is there was a drive-through convenience store that has long since been gone called Big John's Packet. And on the front of Big John's Paquette, there was this big cartoon picture of, I guess, Big John. It was this guy. He had an oversized head, whoever it was. But it was this cartoon character on the front. And people would come by. And this is so funny. I guess this is how this is probably a pretty good indication of how our world has changed from the 90s to now. Because, like, now, like, if people are, like, going to graffiti something, they're going to probably put, like, the F word or something offensive on it. Back in the 90s, though, people would graffiti Big John's Paquette all the time, and it would just be by adding a mustache to Big John. Like, that would be the extent of the graffiti. And he would come out and fix it and remove the mustache, and then a couple months later, somebody would spray paint a new mustache.
What do you think he thought, like, when he went to bed? Like, you think he, like, went to bed, he's like, they did it again. They did it again. They put the mustache on me again.
I'm going to assume he had no sense of humor about it whatsoever. Because the mustache,
probably not.
The mustache was constantly removed. So at some point, you either just embrace it and leave it, or, like, add a goatee or something.
Well, Dave, we're going to talk about one of these, like, local curiosities, which really blew up into something way bigger than it was ever intended to be. It started as just a simple post on the internet and then led to something much bigger than that. It all started in January of this year on Chicago's North Side in a small neighborhood called Roscoe Village, when a Chicago-based artist named Winslow Dumain stumbled upon something that would change the internet forever, a hole in the pavement that is clearly shaped like a rat. Now, while we don't know what the actual origin of the hole is, it's pretty unmistakably a rat, and probably happened when a rat or some other rodent like a squirrel took a leap of faith while the concrete below was wet and just didn't quite stick the landing and splatted its outline into the concrete.
What a way to die.
So, Dave, when Dumain snapped a photo of this and innocently uploaded it to his Twitter account, he could not even at the time have the ability to wrap his mind around what just happened. The phenomenon began going viral, and slowly visitors to the now dubbed rat hole began flooding into the neighborhood to see the site for themselves. As the joke began to take on a life of its own, shrines began appearing around the location, and visitors started the trend of putting coins into the hole like some sort of wishing well. Posting a photo at the rat hole sort of overnight became a central tourist spot attraction for the city of Chicago as a whole, and the city jumped on the trend. Eddie Kristen, a pie maker from Illinois, began selling pies with the shape of the rat hole in the center. Gina Kehoe, a Chicago nail artist, began offering rat hole press-on nail tips. Chicagoans left poems, took shots at the location, and left flowers. People began getting outlines of the rat hole tattooed on their bodies. Dave, even a small wedding ceremony was held at the location. At any given time, you could find people clustered around the hole at all various hours of the day and night. But with something like this, a viral moment in time, it isn't necessarily a win for everyone. Those who lived in the neighborhood long before it became a tourist destination suddenly had to deal with this influx of interest in the sidewalk in front of their home. An anonymous resident of the neighborhood told Thrillist, lots of people think that the rat hole is great because it brings people together, but it was already bringing people together. It was a cute little feature of our community for decades. Now that it's been discovered, it's being used to sell t-shirts and Etsy goods and creates trash for the community it was already a part of. Dave, residents reported trash and broken bottles piling up in their yards, intoxicated people gathering at all hours of the day and night, food laying on the streets that ironically attracted more rats, and a growing sense of frustration at finding parking in front of their own homes gone. Dumaine, the artist who posted the original photo and started the phenomenon unintentionally, suddenly was flooded with messages from residents of the neighborhood expressing their anger and even threatening legal action against him, even though clearly the thing has taken on a life of its own much bigger than anyone had control over at that point. When someone tried to fill the hole with concrete or plaster, maybe a city official or maybe just a disgruntled resident, some rat hole fans scooped it out and to save it and restore the hole to its original condition. Neighbors,
yeah,
neighbors have even contacted the city about potentially removing the entire slab of concrete. And so while the initial hype has clearly died down from what it was at its height now in March, this strange and controversial cultural phenomenon has for some become a rallying cry, a sort of weird, unique mascot of sorts of their community, and for others has become nothing more than a giant headache. Jeff Van Dam, who lives six doors down from the rat hole, told the Washington Post, he thinks the rat hole resonates with people because it turns a stereotypical knock against the city on its head. Chicago's infamous for being infested with rats. In October, the pest control company Orkin declared Chicago the rattiest city in the country for the 9th year in a row, and the imprint morphs that criticism into a point of pride. But to me, Dave, it's this really fascinating example of what happens when we have the internet and how something so insignificant can just bury itself into our brains for better or for worse.
You know, I actually, that changed my opinion on it because I was going to say, man, you just have to embrace something that becomes an unintentional tourist attraction. But then all of a sudden, when you said that, it made me think, well, if they've been the rattiest city in America for 9 consecutive years, it becomes the logo for being the rattiest city in America. Not necessarily a fun, unintentional tourist.
Apparently, it's been there for like 30 years, and everybody in the local area has already known about it. Like they mentioned, there was a softball team that like kind of used it as their unofficial logo for a time. It's just now everybody knows about it, like the secret's out, and it's just like the local people are like, can we just have our thing, please, and not have you all in front of our house all the time?
And that's it. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate, subscribe, and review Commute on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast network. We're on social. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can always say what up at our website, commutethepodcast.com. Music for Commute is provided by my main man, Jason Sammons. For Jasis, and I'm Dave Trump. We'll see you next week.
Well, yes, there is a Mothman statue, which resides in Point Pleasant, which is where the Mothman is from. And for some reason, unbeknownst to us, the artist decided to give him, like, the firmest butt cheeks of all time. Like, I mean, like, it's first of all, it's, like, literally made out of metal. But he sculpted this, like, rock-hard butt on this guy. Like, I don't know why. Like, it's this monster that you go to the back, you're like, okay, well, that was the choice that you made. Recently, though, he was violated. Someone branded the Mothman right above those butt cheeks with a tramp stamp.
Poor guy.
So, you know, you just can't have nice things. You know, you just try to have nice things and somebody's got to ruin it.